I'm going to have to warn you, for any little old ladies who are listening tonight, and any underage children and people in Staten Island, I'll have to warn you, I feel unbelievably, almost obscenely dangerous tonight. I mean, just rotten. I'm liable to say it before we leave the air. And I don't mean that kind of dangerous. I feel dangerous, you know, like, oh, for tomorrow world! That sort of thing, you know. invariably, I'll get a letter. Hey, Mr. Shepherd, I enjoy your program, but if you would only keep your voice at one level, because my husband, Charles, sleeps during your program, and he has to go to work where... Up, hey, up, there, come on, everyone! just the way it is. Now, see, we're cleaning out the dead wood, and those of you who are dead wood know that you're dead wood. Right? Raise your hands. There we go. Very good. No, I tell you, I do feel a little dangerous tonight. I went to this restaurant. I think there are several ways that we can be reminded of our rottenness. And one of the ways that we can be reminded of our rottenness today, Ed, is creeping the downfall of Romanism. You know, the downfall of Romanism. How long has it been since you've been in a really decadent restaurant? I mean the kind of restaurant where you sit there and you just feel fat and greasy by just coming in. You know, you sit down and you can hear tom-toms are going and naked women are walking around serving people, you know, on big silver trays, and they're bringing in boar's heads, big apples in their mouths, and their eyeballs are popping with pate, and flaming battle axes are brought in, and boom, boom. You can hear the sound of tom-toms, and they're, you know, 37 courses, and they're bringing brandy after brandy. They're bringing champagne, caviar, the whole thing. And you're just sitting there, little fat slob from Hammond, Indiana, sitting there shoveling it in, and somehow pretending that you really are a decadent Roman, you know. You really, that no one is more decadent than me. That's terrible when you realize that you're secretly not. Have you ever met a real genuine Playboy reader? They're generally the most innocuous, pimply people. You know, it's all in the mind, and they're always embarrassed by what's in the mind. That's even worse. You know, you don't think Rubirosa is ever embarrassed, do you? Even for a minute, you know, not a bit of it. You know? Never thinks there's any other way of life. Actually, boom, 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 you hear the tom-toms booming and the expense accounts wrestling themselves quietly into oblivion over there in the darkness, wrestling to pick up the check. You know, that's what I'm feeling. Now, friends, seriously, though, we are living in the middle of a dilemma. Most Americans today are not really up to the world that we live in. We all feel a little embarrassed and just slightly guilty. I'm sure that a guy who has driven his car 12 and a half months and is already making noises like we got to get a new one, you know, I'm sure in spite of the fact he's making the noises, there's some little thing that's barking in the background, some little dark little wolf hiding there in the bushes in his mind saying, oh, boop, boop, boop. You know, and he hears the sound of poverty, and he somehow doesn't enter it with the joie de vivre, you know, the savoir-faire, you know, just walk into it, say, give me a new car, and that's it. It is very hard to be Anna Magnani. Very difficult, you know, especially when you come from Cleveland. It's very difficult, and a lot of people try it, but it's not quite as easy as that. And things just miss, you know. You go to a restaurant where it's complete decadence, you say, it's absolute decadence, where it is all creature comforts. Yet, in America, they don't quite know how to do it. There's always one little cog that slips because we are all American. We're all playing at the game. It's like a lot of kids playing post office. You know, they're all sitting around and they peck at each other's cheeks and they make sounds like, oh, boy, oh, boy, that's your net, wow. You know, they fall down and a little peck on the cheek. Oh, 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 boy, oh, hey, Oracle, oh, Jeanette, oh, my God, oh, oh. Nothing's happened. Not a thing has happened. There's a lot of noise about it, but nothing has happened. Nothing. There are few things more puerile nor more innocent than an American who is out to sin. And oh, no, this is a fact. He may think he's a real decadent, rotten sinner, but he's so puerile about it because the first thing he has to do is write about it. which shows automatically he's embarrassed. Anytime I read a writer who goes into great detail about the fantastic orgies, I know that he's embarrassed. Let me tell you, top Romans, when they were involved in orgies, not one of them went home and wrote about it in the diary. It's just a way of life, you know. They don't think about it, they're crying out loud. But it's like this whole country is involved in a gigantic game of post office, and we're afraid we're going to be found out any minute now, you know. Oh, that Jeanette! Oh, boy! yeah. Well, I'm reporting to those of you out there who might not live in the heart of Babylon. You see, you'd be surprised, for those of you who are New Yorkers and you dig in once in a while here, that we get letters for guys who write from places like Clamshell, Maine, you know, way up there. Guys who write from East Loon Lake or Lone Skeleton, Maine, you know, something way up there. Yeah, and you hear the wind soughing through the spruce trees, and he hears an owl calling once in a while over that long, dark part of the lake over there where the pickerel are, and he hears a loon moving out quietly into the night to go to work, and that's about the nightlife. That's about it, you know. And he's sitting there, and really, seriously, and the flicker of the, oh, it's colder than, you know what is it? Who is it that digs wells? I don't know, they get cold somewhere. But, or is it witches? It's something to do with witches, I think. But nevertheless, here he's sitting up there, and he's listening to this report from Babylon. And he has just come from, have you been up in northern Maine? It's really interesting to go into what they consider a very decadent, rich-type restaurant. Really. There's an almost, it's about as decadent as my Aunt Clara's kitchen. You know, they'll have a Toulouse-Lautrec, print on the wall, you know, and there'll be some aunt will come out from behind, somebody's auntie will come out to wait on me, you know, there's a little auntie there, and she has little rimless glasses, and this is called Le Club Elegant. Auntie Min will come out from behind the door there, and the thing will hit her on the back end when she comes through, and she say, "I told you to fix that door, Clarence." And she comes swinging in, and all of a sudden, the French menu just turns out to be Campbell soup and pork and beans with bad French labels on it, you know. And then when you come down here, where they really try to work, they really work at it. I never forget the day I saw the guy fall in the pool at the Four Seasons. And he fell in the pool for a very bad reason. A champagne bottle went off very close to his ear. Now, that would never bother Rubirosa. This guy shied, believe me, he shied like a Kentucky mule. Pow! And in he went right in the pool. They fished him out, and everyone tried to pretend it was a lot of fun. You know, Gregory, just, you know how Greg is. Well, actually, Greg was a good American. Not used to champagne going off right behind his ear, you know. Well, those of you who are interested in the decadent life, it doesn't make it here in New York because everybody's vaguely embarrassed about it. It really is, seriously. Our idea of an elegant hotel, really, the new hotels in New York here, there's a sad, almost a frightening antiseptic quality to them. Really, it's like the men's room of a deep freeze. If you could imagine that raised to 4,000 stories, that's the newest hotels here in town. And yet they're considered very elegant, and they're also considered very decadent. People who go to them think that they're really throwing it around. You know, they're really living up high off a hog. I'm not so sure they have seen some of the Roman, the genuine Roman hotels where the hog is, believe me, the hog lives high up off of you, which is very different, a very different kind of decadence. And you never get used to that kind of thing, you know, when you're an American. I was in this hotel. Did I tell you about the time I was in the fanciest hotel in along the Mediterranean? It's a fantastic hotel in Naples. Well, now, believe me, if you think you've seen decadence, you have not seen Italy. I mean, these guys invented it. I mean, the term "the fall of Rome" came as Italy. You know, those Italians, they were working on it. So, yes. Well, I was in this hotel, and I was with three or four guys who we were on a job. We were going somewhere. Very official types. We checked in there, and we were about to live. We had two nights to live in Naples. Naples. Why, the very word. I will say it to you again. Naples. Oh, boy. You look out of the window, and it's like a gigantic cake of yeast. Naples, believe me, is as if you are suddenly plunged into the middle of a gigantic, unbelievable pot of Ralston that's bubbling and cooking. And somebody somehow is making it out of some rare liqueur that contains possibly opium as one of its chief ingredients. And it's a very heady town. So we walked out on the street, and immediately thousands of the Napoleano came sailing out of. They immediately saw us as a group of brownies, Cub Scouts, arrived in town. You see, and they started to fly around us in formation, and telling us of the strange nocturnal delights that are available. Come on, Visa, you come with me to the Kit Kat Club. Kit Kat Club, very good, the girls, Oh, one thing you must know, that in every major city of the United States, there is one rotten nightclub, usually called the Kit Kat Club, Kit Kat Club, translated Kit Kat Club. Now, this is usually the worst tourist trap in town, you see, automatically. And I don't know whether it's run by the same crowd or not, but in every place... Believe it or not, we kept getting off the plane. We get off the plane in Rome. We get off the plane in Naples. We get off the plane in Beirut, Ed. And every time we'd land, some guy's, oh, the Kit Kat Club, come, I fix you up, Kit Kat, let's go. Well, you see this crowd of Americans heading for the Kit Kat Club, and you see them in there, and they're all, for some reason or other, they're all buying pandas. Stuffed pandas from the same girl who must make the route, a tall, thin girl who sits down and drinks tea with you at $17 a glass. She says it's brandy. And she sits down immediately. Oh, one thing, I'll never forget one of the wild scenes that I saw in a Kit Kat Club. The proprietor, there's always a proprietor named Jacques or Henri. Something like that, and he's one of these greasy types who looks like he's made entirely out of oleo. And he's been carved out of a block of oleo. Remember when they used to make little Santa Clauses out of butter? Well, here is old Jacques. He's been carved out of oleo, and he's wearing this unbelievable tuxedo that he's got. He's been wearing the same tuxedo now since he left the mafia in 1931, you know, when they kicked him all out of Cicero. And he's now back in the home territory there, and he's wearing his tuxedo with the plush lapels and the whole thing. And he meets, oh, gentlemen, I'm so glad you come to the Kit Kat. Come in, come on, let's go. Well, he greets you at the door, and immediately he sees you are lonely. He says, oh, you're lonely, you're not me. I have Nisa here. Nisa, she just sit there and talk, you tell you about the Roma. Well, the girl comes over and says, Nisa, she sits down, and you find that you're being charged $17 a minute for her just to sit with you. And they put it on the bill. That's what's fascinating. It says one girl on the bill to sit with. Kit Kat Club. Well, as I say, decadence. Speaking of decadence, this is WOR AM and FM New York, the home of the John Gambling Show. Speaking of decadence. And, he's very good on the time. He really is good on time. And he's excellent. He's one of the best people I know to tell you it's going to rain. He's very good. And when it comes for school reports, he's the best man in town. He'll tell you all about those schools. I think, though, that Americans, more and more, I dig being an American. I was out with a French guy last night, a very official type. And he starts telling me this fantastic cock and bull story about how he went out someplace, and he tried to tell me, he's one of these guys, he says, a policeman here in town, I cannot understand how you live in this city. I come in as a policeman. They have me down up against the wall, and they tie my hands behind me, and they take my belt off of my trousers. And I said, what did you do? I think he's got busted, you know. I don't know what this guy's up to, you know. they run him in. They hit him with a rubber hose. He says, a rubber hose, heat. And I said, what happened, Jacques? And he says, well, I walk against the light. I walk against it. Oh, come on. You know, and I don't know what they busted this clown for. But the thing that was important was that everybody sitting around there, we know that nobody's going to pull you in the jail. any cop, take your belt and throw you into a cell, you know, and they take your cufflinks off and because you walked against the light. It just isn't done. But here's what was interesting. All the people at the table, all of them Americans, they knew this was you've often been warned by a cop, that kind of stuff. They all agreed with him. You know, and I found myself agreeing, that's terrible. That's terrible. He says, it would not happen in Paris. Not in Paris, the policeman. And I thought, oh. Well, the thing I think that's so delightful about Americans is that the Americans immediately accept any rotten thing that's said about them by anybody from any other country. Immediately, we applaud it. We not only applaud it, says we deserved it all the way down the line. And we are pathologically, almost pathologically, unable to accept the truth about any other country. We will not accept, we will not believe that there is anything but little gnomes and Barry Fitzgeralds all over Ireland. We won't accept that there might be a couple of rotten guys anywhere, you know. Can't possibly be. And if they are rotten, they were made rotten by that rotten American who went over there. That's how they got rotten. Well, that's a distinctly American trait. In fact, a friend of mine had, of course, we do that all the way down the line. A friend of mine had a very discouraging experience, and he was a real hard-hitting, total. You know, there's the total conservative and there's the total liberal. Now, both of them are nutty, because anybody who's totally anything is in trouble. Believe me. Well, the total conservative, we don't even have to talk about that guy. I mean, talk about paleontological examples of ossification. But the total liberal has got another problem, too. You see, any time anybody's called a communist by a senator, he gets mad. What do you mean? Oh, that's not what... You know, immediately he will defend the guy who's been called a communist by the senator till he's dead. He just absolutely automatically assumes that all senators are nuts. You know, that can't be. Well, this friend of mine, this is a story I shouldn't even tell you. It's a very discouraging story. Well, this guy went out, and he was really, you know, he's a rock bomb, but he also was a writer, Ed. He's a writer and an editor, and he's very good at research and that kind of thing. So one day, there was a guy that had been accused of being a communist or something, you know, one of these things, and he was accused of being this by some big top senator, and it was said that he was being blacklisted unfairly and all that, and he was not a communist and so on, you know, the whole business. So he decides he's really going to help this guy, this guy that was accused of that. And so he goes out and he starts to research. You see, he wanted to get the real story, so he researched all over the place, and he came up with a terrible thing. By the way, this guy was about to go on and blow up the senator. He was really mad, you know, he was going to really blast the senator and everything. He went around and he starts to research, and he found out this guy was not only a communist, Ed, he was a communist in spades. And not only was he a communist in spades, he literally was the kind that did make bombs in his basement. Well, he was very embarrassed. I mean, it was really terrible because he'd been, you know, yelling and hollering. So I said to him, well, what are you going to do about this, Charlie? I mean, you're going to write the article now? He said, why, of course not. He said, why, I would never say that about him. Well, you see what I mean? It's on both sides. You see, it's a nutty thing. And this is distinctly American, I think. I don't believe, well, maybe not. Maybe not. I, of course, you start out as a kid learning this kind of stuff very early as a kid. I think that Americans will put up with almost anything unless it is publicly stated that it's happening. Well, so will the British. I think this is a British and American trait, that everybody in England knew about all this stuff that's involved in the Parfumo case, you know. Everybody knew about it. But the point that got very, very got very hot was that they said it. You know, it came out. Somebody said it. Then they had to do something about it. Then that made a very sticky situation. We were in very bad trouble, you know. It was very sticky. It's just like, again, this integration thing, which is interesting, that all of us have known that segregation has existed for a long time in the South. Well, we also know it exists in the North, you know. This is no question about it. You can kid yourself all you want, but it's a different kind up in the North. There are no signs in the North. So somehow, in our nutty, twisted mind, it doesn't exist then. That the minute somebody down South would put up a big sign, white, colored, you know, then, oh boy, everybody's mad, you know, because he really said it, you see. He put it out. And so we have to do something about that because it is stated, literally stated, you know, it is a stated policy. Whereas I can tell you this, and you know, there's no question about it, that many of the top chic, very, very top in clubs in northern cities, just by odd coincidence, don't happen to have Negroes. That's all. There's no sign that says they can't come in, nothing like that. They just don't happen to have them, that's all. And so it's populated. Incidentally, these clubs are populated by large numbers of angry guys writing editorials about segregation in Birmingham. You know this, don't you? Oh, you didn't know it? That's another particular. Of course, I don't think that's a particularly American trait. I think that's a human trait, more or less. That a friend of mine spent a few years in India, and he was talking about Indians and he was talking to a very high-born Indian of a very high caste in New Delhi. And of course, the argument always comes up to the fact that the Indians are humanists, and they trot out Gandhi, and they're always discussing high, almost totally rarefied concepts of abstract attitudes towards man, the eternal infinite, and so on. Is sitting there, and he's feeling like an absolute slob, you know. And the high-born Indian is telling him about what a fantastic civilization they've created and so on. And all the while, you know, he's sitting there, my American friend, is feeling very, very embarrassed, you know, but, you know, after all, he keeps thinking of Cleveland. And he keeps thinking of Queens, and this man is talking about these great abstract concepts. It's the, you know, the Krishna Menon thing, the Nehru thing. You somehow assume Nehru knows God. And it's just something that's there's a feeling there. Well, he walks out of the place, and of course it's 150 degrees, and he goes about three blocks through thousands of beggars, covered with lepers and one thing and another, just an indescribably. It's like I don't know whether you've ever been to India, but it's a really a genuine experience. And on the, and then you in a place like India, you really do see the difference between man's rarefied abstract concept of himself and his reality. And so it seems that all the intellectuals of this area had completely left reality. No intellectual hardly ever talks about the people out there starving in the streets and one thing and another. And they have just left it totally. Which you know, it's an American thing. It's an Indian thing. But over there, it's carried to a 4,000 year final total attitude. It's like currently, there's a lot of little things that are popping on the front. There is a belief in America that is beginning to slowly evolve that there is a class of people who are beyond laws. And if they, oh yes, this is the hip, swinging hip, we can go even further than that. It goes into the Playboy, the whole attitude of laws are drag, man. They're for Squaresville. Well, this is a new kind of fascism. This is a new kind. Well, it really isn't a new kind, because that's actually what Hitler was saying, too. He talked about an elite. They created laws, but the laws were for everybody else, of course, because it was assumed that since they were an elite and they were much better people by the natural order of things, that the laws that govern the rabble, those little people walking around the streets, certainly shouldn't govern them. Because they're the ones that create the laws. Very different thing. Things are moving, you know. Really, it's a kind of an expense account aristocracy. They fly into a rage when anybody decides to tax them or to make them pay for something. It's a terrible thing. They fly into an awful rage. I know one of the members of the expense account aristocracy, literally, who has not paid for anything in her life for probably 20 years, including her furniture, every possible thing she lives in, everywhere. She travels around the world. And so now she accepts this as the natural order of things. She is a totally privileged human being. Never thinks in terms of paying. And it's those other people, those little people. She doesn't even think about the little people paying. It's just they're paying. They pay, that's all. She assumes. And this is a new kind of aristocracy, which, because a person does have privilege, he begins to assume that he has earned the privilege. That's a dangerous thing, too. In other words, because people applaud you, you believe that you're worthy of it. which is highly questionable. And because people are allowed to escape laws one kind or another and are allowed to live pretty much in their own area and completely accepting their privilege, these people then begin to believe that the reason that they have these privileges is because they're literally better people. There's a kind of supercilious superiority that begins to develop. Have you ever been around? I have a friend, for example. I have a friend who has a thing. In fact, two or three. In fact, I remember one time a juvenile officer, a friend of mine, his teenage kid suddenly became involved with a guy who was like 17 times her age, and he went out of his skull and threatened to kill the guy. Now you see, it's a problem. It's a, because he felt that he was privileged to do this because it was him. That's all. It was because it's me. He said, "Well, it's different. It's me." And these other guys, the other laws, the laws apply to the other people. And this is a growing thing in our country. Very definitely a growing thing. And you'll find all kinds of rabble-rousers are rallying to various types of philosophy that claims that the laws are built for literally to keep the other people in line. Did you read the comment that one of the integration leaders made recently? It wasn't integration, it was the non-integration leader. Yeah, let's say he's the Faubus of the other side, Malcolm X. There was a little thing in Life magazine where somebody says, "Well, don't you think that some of these things can be excesses with these people?" He says, "No." He says, anything that they do," he's talking about the various demonstrators, "he says, anything they do is right because they're doing it." Well, that's an interesting attitude towards law. You know, carry that to a far extreme, and boy, you have got the stormtroops, literally. Because that's the kind of thing that swept through Germany in the 20s. And there it was. People accepted it, unfortunately, because in the end we sort of do. There's an odd thing that a person will kind of accept the behavior, say, of, say, some great film star. Some wild behavior. Illegal, incidentally, in many cases. Totally illegal. We'll kind of accept it because we are tacitly admitting that there is a super class. You see, there is a super class. This is this problem of drugs is always shown that way, that many a top performer, for example, can get by with being involved with drugs, but let the elevator operator get caught with a couple of decks on him and look out, it's like 20 years, he's had it, you know. Again, because we tacitly sort of admit that there is a kind of privilege class. Now, we will associate that with the artistic class. We can associate with all kinds of things until finally, in the end, we assume that anybody who is doing it, who has enough money and power, is automatically part of that class and hence becomes artistic. He becomes, you know, many, have you noticed how many of the film leaders, the really big film stars, are attracted to gangsters? Well, because it's the attraction of one privileged class for another. That a gangster, when he reaches a certain point, is practically beyond the law. He really is. That the really top gangster is hardly ever touched by the law. Many of his little henchmen are occasionally. But, you know, that's another interesting thing. I've never heard anybody really talk much about it. Is the feeling of superiority that a genuine criminal has for the people around him. He really does feel he's a superior person. Not an inferior person, a superior. Oh, yes, he really does. He's a very superior to the guy who has to work. In fact, he has all kinds of derisive phrases, all kinds of slang for guys at work, which refer, in a sense, refer to the squares or the less endowed, the less talented people. And so you will find, oh, yeah, you will find that classes of people, regardless of what they seem to be doing, are drawn together. And so you've noticed, you remember a few years ago when people were raising Cain because there were lots of film stars hanging around with, Luciano and Costello and Mickey Cohen and all that crowd. Well, now, when you get to be a top government official, when you get to be a president or you get to be the head of some great, you also are in a privileged situation. I mean, let's face it. What do you think it does to a guy? Now, what do you think it does to a guy
who has a car. Listen to this for 1 minute, guys. What do you think it does to a man personally? What do you think it would do to you? Now, seriously, consider this for a minute. If for one reason or another, you are issued a gigantic automobile and three people to walk beside you to protect you from anything that might happen. Now, your car has a number on it. It's got a plate, a license plate, and it says 3, you see. Now, on top of that, it has two telephones in the back that you don't answer. A secretary rides in the car that answers the phone for you. Then, as you drive down the street, two motorcycle cops are ahead of you. And when you pull up, you don't, and nobody says, the secretary doesn't relay the message from the chauffeur to you, but we can't find a parking place, boss. Oh, boy. You don't think that Zeckendorf looks for a parking place, do you? Please. And so what happens, you know, after a while, how do you think you feel towards all those people that are walking around out in the streets out there who are looking for parking places? Just really think about it for a minute. Interesting thought, isn't it? Because most of us are in that group of just walking around on the streets. We can never conceive of that other crowd. Well, they have an interesting attitude towards the world. And regardless of what they do to get there, the privilege is the same. And so you have a top gangster. He doesn't look for parking places, please. I'm sorry. He does not look for parking places. Now here you've got, an enormous producer of something. He produces things, you know, gigantic thing. He's Daddy Warbucks, you see. He would have an absolute affinity with Frank Costello. Sure he would, because they are both riders of the back seat, you know, and all the rest of the crowd is out there. Now, on the other hand, Cary Grant would have affinity. I don't know whether he does or not, but many movie stars who live that kind of life also have an affinity, because, you see, it's like an aristocracy. Very interesting thing. It's an aristocracy. So then you get down to the bottom, and you'll find that the top hippie, you go down to McDougal Street, they also have a secret feeling of alliance with the stars and with the gang. Yes, they do. They put them down, but the first instant the door is open, they're sitting in that back seat because they also feel they're sitting on the sideline. They are above the laws. Now they are, it's a very subtle problem. So somebody will come along. Now, this is what's called fascism. Somebody will come along and organize all of that. That's why you'll get this nutty conglomerate in say, something like Hitler's Germany, a nutty conglomerate of people ranging all the way from the hippies who haven't got, they can't even know where to get, they don't know where they can go buy their next guitar string, you know. And you'll get that group all the way on up to the top film stars and the top industrialists in some nutty way all tied up in one genuine attitude, whether they really believe it. There are the privileged there is the economically privileged, there is the sexual privileged, who feels that all those rotten laws are made to take care of people, those other people who are not, you know, like as hip as I am. There are the drug hippies, who get very moral, by the way, when they hear not paying parking tickets. They get very moral about it. If you're interested in an article that has something to do with this, pick up a copy of the current Reporter magazine. It's the LSD cult at Harvard. It's a fascinating example of this kind of thing growing. Oh, yes. It's all part of the same phenomenon. And so eventually, you'll find that almost all of these people, in one way or another, read Ayn Rand, you see, because she is advocating that too, you see. In a highly obscure form, but nevertheless the same thing. She is saying that there is a class of real, honest, clean-limbed people, and they should rule. That's it. Because they're honest, clean-limbed, hard-hitting, dynamic. And of course, dynamic means a lot of things. Costello was dynamic because, after all, you know, when 35 young thugs are coming up, the one that wins out is pretty dynamic. Believe me, he's pretty dynamic. It isn't easy to become Mr. Big, even though you just say, well, I'll be a gangster. Oh, no. It's pretty tough row. It's just as tough to become the head of the syndicate as it is to become president of General Motors. And many of the same qualities are involved. Many of the same qualities. Ruthlessness, drive, fantastic ambition, the ability to use men, the ability to move them around, the ability to get them to get other guys to delegate authority, all the same thing. So one of they recognize each other. I happen to know a guy in this country who is a top, an absolutely top, completely unparalleled top industrialist. And one of his best friends is a currently operating dictator, who, by the way, is dynamically opposed and diametrically opposed in his so-called philosophy against capitalism. See, everybody keeps thinking that what a guy talks about is what he believes in. No, what I'm trying to tell you here is that a top law enforcement officer has a certain affinity for Al Capone. They're both top men. It doesn't make any difference what field they're tops in. Not even getting that a dictator. That's why Hitler and Stalin could get together, in spite of the fact that their philosophies were diametrically opposed. They were both top men and recognized each other as that. They were dictators. It doesn't make any difference what their program is. So forget that. And dictators. And the guys who are the power people. Always recognize the privileged class, and I'm not talking about a privileged class economically. That's the old idea. We always used to think that privilege means economic privilege. Anytime a guy's got a lot of money, he's privileged. Well, do you or do you not believe seriously that a guy who is a hippie, a real hippie, does he think he's part of a privileged class? Oh yeah, he'll deny it. But I'm sorry, you know, I've been involved too long with it. And I know that this is true. Yet he may not have a nickel. Now he will also. Have you noticed also too? There's a certain violence. You see, then there's the privilege of the. There's the privileged class of the physical. Now that brings in another attitude. Have you noticed that many film stars are attracted to boxers? Have you noticed that many top industrialists are wild boxing fans? Oh yes, and top boxers. They're never fans of little club fights. They'll be a Patterson fan, or they'll be a Sonny Liston fan. Oh, yes. Because, again, the same kind of drive, the same combativeness, the same kind of just knock-em-down quality that must be in a man to make him rise to the head of, say, General Motors, that must be in a man to make him rise to the head of MGM Pictures. Do you know how many people a guy has to knock down on the way to becoming a movie star? Believe me. So he knocks him down in another way, you see. Sonny Liston knocks him down very basically. Bang! In the mouth, he knocks him down. Well, he's knocking him down just the same, though, as say, a top film star who has knocked down many people on his way to get where he finally gets. You'll find also that a top writer, generally, who really is a top writer, who feels that he's a privileged person, too. Many writers do because of the same thing. They feel that they're privileged because of their superior insight or one thing or another. That they are attracted to boxers. I've known dozens of them that are attracted to boxers. They're attracted to dictators. They're attracted to all kinds of interesting power people. It resolves itself into is that there really are two kinds of people. There's the passive people, and this is probably 99.999% of the world. These are the people who just get up in the morning and do what they have to do and go to bed again. And that's it, you know. They've fallen into whatever slot it is by accident, or what, you know, they've fallen into their job or their career, profession, whatever it is. Maybe their father was a doctor, so they're a doctor. Their father worked in the mill, so they work in the mill. Or one day they were walking down the street and they met a guy who says, an old friend of mine. So they wind up working at the agency. But they're passive people. Things happen to them. Well, then there's the other kind of person, much rarer. This is the active person, the activist, really. He's the guy who causes things to happen, good, bad, or indifferent. Now, that may sound like he's a good man. Oh, no, Hitler was an activist, you know. A lot of things that the activists do are not good. So they know each other, too. A really dynamic activist knows another one, in no matter what field it is. And even if their attitudes are diametrically opposed. And so you have this strange little level that exists always in every country. There are always the guys, the gang, the club. And eventually they even wind up with little places called the club. You know, they have a little place where only the very few of us are admitted to that sort of thing. It's an intriguing thing, and it has very little to do with money. It's the look in the eye. It's a lot of other things that are involved in this. And so this friend of mine, I said this top industrialist, he really finds this dictator very simpatico. And I kept saying, well, you know, your philosophies are, oh, come on, what are you talking? That's, we don't even discuss that. Well, sure. You don't think a top film star sitting with a gangster at ringside in Las Vegas discusses vice or rum running? Of course not. See, we don't really, nor does the top gangster discuss making films with the film star. It's two stars together is what it really is. Who cares what their stars in you? And they know it, you know. They just know it. It's a thing, and they're usually born, you know. They're born that way, and I'm sure that at about the age of seven, everybody in the family knows that little Fred is different from the other people, you know. That when there's any clothespin stolen, Freddy's got him in his back pocket. When there's any people with a bloody nose, it ain't Freddy. When there's any broken windows, it ain't Freddy. Or at least it ain't Freddy that's caught. That little Freddy always knows how to land on his feet invariably. And not only that, little Freddy knows how to make other people land on other places other than their feet. Right from the very beginning, all the way on up and down. It doesn't make any difference what he selects as a career. He's going to get there. Mickey Cohen could have been a top movie star. Just remember that. When Frank Costello walks down the street, you can just see him starring in those B movies for Warner Brothers, you know? And on the other hand, when Khrushchev is banging, you can see him heading General Motors, can't you? Same thing, you know, it's all up to him.
This is WOR.